And this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And that was the Syrian national anthem. We played it because President Obama thinks he can name the president of Syria. He cannot do that. So we want to underline that fact because it's very important the United Nations functions. But incidentally, all this stuff of foreign intervention from those parties who are saying that they, in the name of humanitarian intervention or whatever else they've created as an excuse, do not have any authorization. There's no UN authorization for the United States and France and others to drop any bombs on the territory of Syria. And for those who would say, well, Russia is, that's true. Russia has been invited by the Syrian government to assist in its defense, which is a legal right of any state. It can call on other parties if it's subject to assault. And you can debate it if you like, go to the United Nations or go somewhere else, some other forum. But in fact, Syria is a sovereign state, and that's why we are arguing in this program. That needs to be underlined and talk the matter out at the UN or anywhere else. But meanwhile, they remain sovereign. We are joined, I believe, by Zafar Bengash of Crescent International. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes, Phil, I am.
Well, Zafar, I'm very glad to be talking to you because we spoke to you a week ago.
Yes.
And along the way, you speculated that a possible coup might happen in Turkey. So since it did happen, we have to ask you, did you have any prior knowledge? Or what was your role in the coup?
I'll tell you.
Attempted coup.
I want to make it clear to your listeners that I absolutely had no contact with the generals who tried to bring about a coup.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is, I think some of them are listening to the Taylor Report, for sure.
Well, good. Now I'm in trouble.
So I think what they did was they thought, well, if people in Canada are talking about it, what a brilliant idea. Let's do it.
Well, just to continue with this, I could point out that your publication, crescent-online.net, is, I know, read around the world,
and
in the Islamic world, and definitely and particularly in that region.
Yes, of course.
People have to be up to speed. We're finding out there are people, and this is going to get us into this discussion of the Turkey, is there are people who in North America, besides the governments, who have big roles. Now,
yes.
And one of these people, to start with this individual, Mr. Gulen.
Yes.
He lives in Pennsylvania. And according to the government of Turkey, Mr. Doyan had a role in this business. And further to that, I saw the New York Times and the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, they all said he denies it, has no role, he's against it. However, he added, he couldn't say that his people weren't involved.
Yes, that's correct.
So see, who is he, and what do you think he was involved in? What role, what
well,
does he want?
I simply cannot discount his role in this coup attempt because Fethullah Gulen is a person that left Turkey in 1999. At that time, prior to that, he and Mr. Erdogan were very close to each other, but later on they had a falling out. And that falling out, of course, occurred about 4 or 5 years ago, or perhaps a little earlier, but it came to the surface in 2013 when members of this group, it's called the Gulenist group, or, you know, they actually their organization is called Khizmat, which means service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he has, although he's a sort of unofficial individual, this organization runs thousands of schools, not only in Turkey, but in other parts of the world as well, including here in Canada, right here in Toronto, in Etobicoke, they have a number of schools.
Mm-hmm.
The members of this group have definitely penetrated the armed forces, the judiciary, the police force, universities, the bureaucracy, you name it, and members of his group are involved in these. And the reason why Mr. Erdogan is pointing an accusing finger at Mr. Gulen is that the general who was leading the coup, his name is General Erdal Uzturk, who was the commander of the Third Army. That is a highly decorated general. He's an Air Force general. And he had also served as a military attaché in Israel for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me explain to you. Mr. Gulen, when he first came to the U.S. in 1999, he made an application for a green card, which means, you know, he applied to become a sort of permanent resident of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
His application was turned down. So then two individuals in particular came forward. Now, this is very, very interesting, and this sort of sheds light on the connections that Mr. Gulen has in these very high-powered situations or positions.
Mm-hmm.
The two individuals that sponsored his application, one of them was Graham Fuller. Now, Graham Fuller is now retired, but for 30 years he was an analyst with the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And the second individual...
And a station chief, right?
Yes, exactly. And the second mm-hmm. person that sponsored his application was Daniel Pipes. Now, Daniel Pipes is well known as a very, very hardcore pro-Zionist individual. And, of course, Mr. Gulen lives in the same area where Daniel Pipes is located.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't sort of, you know, checked this out, but it is inconceivable that Mr. Pipes would not be in touch with Mr. Gulen, and they're not communicating and not mm-hmm. sort of, you know, interacting, etc. So, for sure, I think the Gulenists were involved in the coup, number one. Secondly, the Turkish government has said, including the prime minister as well as the president, that the U.S. government itself was behind it. And I think the fact that Mr. Gulen is here in the U.S., and when the Turkish government asked that the U.S. should extradite him, John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, said that the U.S. would be prepared to accept that, provided Turkey was able to provide conclusive proof of his involvement.
Yeah. By the way, Zephyr, just to support that, if you don't mind, I'd like to read those words, because it's one of the wormiest mealy-mouthed sentences I've ever seen. And of course, Kerry is a master of this kind of language. But here's what he wrote.
Yes.
We fully anticipate that there will be questions raised about Mr. Gulen. And obviously, we invite the government of Turkey to present us with any legitimate evidence that withstands scrutiny, and the United States will accept that and look at it and make judgments appropriately, and I am confident there will be some discussion about that.
Exactly. Now, I want to draw...
We've got a criminal we'd like you to turn... And they get that back?
Exactly. Now, let me draw a parallel between this and what George W. Bush said immediately after September the 11th attacks. He demanded that Afghanistan and the Taliban regime over there hand over Osama bin Laden. And the Taliban said, we would like to see some evidence of Mr. Osama bin Laden's involvement in this, and we'd be very happy to hand him over to you if there is credible evidence that he was involved in this attack. And George Bush's response was, we will provide you the evidence in Kabul. We are coming. So, obviously, you know, Mr. Erdogan cannot send his Air Force or Army to Washington, D.C.
That would really be his only solution.
Yes.
Not recommended, but...
So, you see...
This is a problem of thinking you can speak back to the master, I guess.
That's correct, yes. You see, so now you see, now that the shoe is on the other foot, the response from the U.S. is very different. And, in fact, I would say, I'm no fan of Mr. Erdogan because he has done a lot of terrible things, but... you know, he did sort of, you know, point out that we have, since the U.S. is our ally, and any time the U.S. has asked us to extradite anybody that they accuse of being involved in acts of terrorism, we have promptly handed over these individuals to the U.S. to be tried in a U.S. court of law.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the shoe is on the other foot, we expect the U.S. to do the same. And you just read Mr. Kerry's statement as to how convoluted that statement is. It's sort of, you know, full of loopholes. He's taking, you know, these acrobatics.
It seems to be all loopholes and no point, actually.
Yes.
Just, it is a lawyer's brief of the most low variety.
Yes.
And by the way, now the Islamic Republic spoke to Erdogan.
Yes.
And I'm interested in your thoughts about that. But one of the points they might have made over the phone was, we once asked for the Shah.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, he was...
The Good
Shah
luck
was,
with...
Exactly. In the U.S. and the Islamic Republic asked for him to be extradited. Instead of extraditing him to Iran, they sent him to Panama. And then from Panama, he went to Egypt. And again, the Islamic Republic asked the Egyptian government, at that time Anwar Sadat was the president, that this man is wanted for crimes against humanity. This man has perpetrated horrific crimes through...
And there was really no doubt about it.
Exactly. I mean, there is ample evidence that, you know, his intelligence agency, SAVAK, that was trained by the CIA, guided by the CIA, had perpetrated horrific crimes, torture, and all kinds of terrible things. And then the Shah's army had, you know, done a lot of terrible things. Anybody who visits the Islamic Republic can go and see the prisons that the Shah maintained. I mean, I've been to some of them. I can tell you, they were horrific, absolutely horrific. You know, when you enter there, your hair literally stands on your body because it's so the entire atmosphere is so frightening. You know,
yes. and the which prison, as it was designed
exactly, yeah. exactly.
But that is it. Just shows we're dealing with an empire, and they say things like, "Show us the paperwork," and you do, and they laugh. But if you have somebody they want, they will invade you.
Yeah.
This is Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. And we're speaking, of course, about this coup attempt and what it might all mean. And I want to just one last thing further about Mr. Gulen. In his application, he said he was an educator. And they made the finding that he actually is not an educator. But he isn't he? One of the things they said is he's extremely wealthy, and he builds institutions where people are paid a lot of money who are in fact academics, at least nominally. And so it's like a kind of a fraud in a way. But what about his wealth? Where did he get all of his money? And isn't that kind of a big element in this?
Yes. I think most of his wealth comes from the people that are his followers. These are wealthy individuals inside Turkey. And, of course, they run a huge publishing empire, both inside Turkey as well as in other places. I've traveled around the world, and I'm struck by the fact that the number of schools that they have opened in different parts of the world, including, for instance, in places like South Africa and Malaysia and, you know, Pakistan, other places, and as I mentioned, even here in Canada. Although in these schools, naturally, at least in Canada, the students do pay their tuition fees, etc., and teachers are paid. But in other places, these schools are run on the basis of... they not being charged anything because, let's say, in South Africa, in some of these townships where most of the Africans reside, the conditions over there are really terrible, even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, naturally, the people would welcome something, help of that kind. But his wealth, I would say, number one, comes from his wealthy supporters inside Turkey. And Turkey is a very rich country, by the way. And it cannot be put past Mr. Gulen that he's receiving some money from some intelligence agencies like the CIA because, you know, they do keep various people on their payroll to achieve their objectives in different parts of the world.
The U.S. warehouses a lot of can-be presidents.
Oh, absolutely.
In case they need them.
Exactly. That is so.
They're just out of the blue. They say, oh, well, we happen to have a prince living here. And suddenly he's in charge. This is, again, it's Zephyr Benkash. And we've had the jolt of the attempt, and it seems to have been based in the Air Force, and the gentleman you mentioned.
Yes.
And just looking at the region, Saudi Arabia apparently has been unhappy with this, with Erdogan. They were clearly unhappy in the weeks before the attempt. As a matter of fact, wasn't it Saudi Arabia that was spreading the word that there was something wrong with Erdogan, with apologizing to the Russians? And then this odd thing, and I wonder if you could explore that a little bit. I don't know how solid the story was, but there was at least the foreign ministers publicly said they were thinking about normalizing relations with Syria, which is, has to be ground zero for the problem.
Yes, of course. You see, when Erdogan was facing difficulties at home, particularly with respect to his policy on Syria, because it was not getting anywhere, and naturally the Turkish economy has suffered as a consequence of two unrelated issues. The first, of course, is the borders that Russia has closed for Turkish goods. Russian tourists are no longer coming to Turkey. It's a major blow to Turkey, and naturally, tourism is a major source of earning for the Turkish economy. And then recently, of course, we had the bombings at Istanbul Airport. This was not just the Istanbul Airport, but prior to that, there were a number of developments taking place that, again, had affected the tourism industry because Turkey was becoming quite an unsafe place. Mm-hmm. So Erdogan thought that he should try to make up with Russia and try to sort of, you know, secure that front. And there were hints because after Davutoglu, his prime minister, was removed, and it was Ahmed Davutoglu who was basically the architect of the Syria policy. And so once he was removed, there was speculation that perhaps now Turkey would try to mend fences with Syria as well, because mm-hmm. that policy has completely failed. There is now blowback from some of these terrorist groups that feel betrayed, that Turkey is no longer supporting them as fully as they would want. In fact, I don't think that it is Turkey's fault in that sense. Turkey still wants to support the terrorists, but I think the ground realities in Syria have changed. We mm-hmm. talked about it last week as well, that the area near the Turkish border is now no longer under the control of those terrorists. They've been cut off from the Turkish border, particularly in Manbij, which is now besieged by Kurdish forces. And then you have Raqqa, which is the terrorist capital city. The Syrian army is pretty close to that. Today's news was that the Syrian army has completely surrounded Aleppo. So you see that the terrorists are getting trapped. Mm-hmm. And so if they cannot get any supplies of weapons or manpower yes. or food, et cetera, then that would be the end of the game.
And
for
it
them.
Was anticipated that Turkey, the issue, if it came to that, Turkey would have to make its mind up of whether it was going to intervene.
Exactly.
And given what's been happening in Turkey, at least for there's no sign that they are going to do that.
Well, even if there was any plan to do that before, I think this is now out of the question because there are major difficulties now inside the armed forces. I mean, you know, Erdogan and his supporters in the army may have controlled the situation for now, but I think they would really, really have to address this issue seriously, and they have to sort this out. Mm-hmm. And if they go on a revenge spree, I think that would really be very, very detrimental to Turkey.
Which, by the way, there are accusations that's what's happening, right? I
mean, yes, unfortunately. They've already, the Turkish prime minister has said that more than 7,000 people have been arrested, or 7,500. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, some of Erdogan's supporters have indulged in vigilante type of attacks against people mm-hmm. that have been, that are perceived as pro-coup or whatever. They've killed some people in a horrible manner. I think these kinds of things ought to be avoided. Otherwise, Turkey would face very serious problems for the foreseeable future. And it will all depend on how much statesmanship Erdogan can show and his supporters, because at this time, it's a critical test for them as to whether they can sort of really deal with the troublemakers and not victimize people that they perceive to be, you know, not their supporters or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a very serious mistake if they were to go along that route.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have to add that factor that Mr. Erdogan is rather like, in some ways, just with the way we talk about Donald Trump, is a very unpredictable individual.
He
takes almost everything personally.
That's correct, yes.
Over the years, we remember kind of dramatic moments with him where in public he will behave kind of in shocking ways. He had the run-in with President Shamir of Israel.
Yes.
Where they were sitting together, and suddenly Erdogan heard something he didn't like from Mr. Shamir. He just got up and walked off.
Yes.
And left a few wicked comments.
Yes, but that was at
Davos. And then later had to reverse himself.
Yeah, that was at Davos at the World Economic Forum. And, of course, he returned home to a hero's welcome because at that time,
everybody thought he was going to take a stand against Israel's aggression.
Exactly. But that was just basically, now we know it was just theatrics and sort of, you know, his recent rapprochement with Israel. Mm-hmm. When earlier on he was insisting that the siege of Gaza be lifted, and all Israel offered was that they would allow Turkish goods to go to the Gaza Strip, but they would have to go through the Israeli port. They cannot go to Gaza directly. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the situation hasn't changed materially, whether mm-hmm. it's Turkish ships taking those goods to Israeli ports or any other ships. So long as Israel has the lock to the gate, then it's still the same situation. So mm-hmm. Erdogan, unfortunately, has surrendered that option as well.
Yeah. Again, it's Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. When we discuss, we're almost at the same position we were in last week's discussion, in that the question is, he has a strong political base, but he has conflicting goals. And the question is, you know, we went through this attempted coup, and as you're outlining it, one has that feeling we might see more coups or more coup attempts because somebody has to settle the dispute inside his party. But what about his history and all that? Is he, of all these people, is he the one most likely to survive this?
You see, what he is trying to do is to grab as much power in his own hand as possible. Now, that's mm-hmm. a very slippery slope. If he continues to do that, he's definitely going to run up against other people that do not like it, and the most likely people.
Can he change course? Can he, for example, if he were to say in a couple of 3 days, all right, we're going to continue what we were doing. We're going to normalize relations with Syria, which would mean close the borders if it's normal. So would he be able to survive because the West would throw everything at him, wouldn't they?
Yes. I don't think that he would do it. I don't think he can do it. I think it's in his nature. He has a very, very stubborn streak. And I think what he would do is try to use this coup to tighten his grip on power even more. And mm-hmm. I think that would be sad because it would antagonize more people. It would provide more opportunities for mm-hmm. coup makers, etc. And they would say, well, look, you know, you can see, even though there was a failed attempt, a miserable attempt, but what he is doing is unacceptable as well. So I think there will be further trouble.
Let me ask you a sharp question apropos of that. What about Turkish opinion and NATO? Isn't NATO a curse for Turkey?
Oh, absolutely. I think, unfortunately, you know, Turkey has...
Patriotic Turks who say, look, why don't we do the grown-up thing and move away from this?
Well, they wouldn't, because I think Erdogan sort of, you know, is afraid that if he were to do that, you see, the military would not let him do that. At the present time, he has a man in running the military who is his man. But when it comes to the military's institutional interest, then the friendship would not come in the way. Then they would stand up for their institutional interest. Mm-hmm. So the military would not move away from NATO because they see a major advantage to them as a consequence mm-hmm. of being a member of NATO.
Well, now he's accused NATO, accused the U.S.,
yeah.
and he's had a couple of phone calls to Putin, and he's had phone calls to the Islamic Republic. Would you anticipate that will continue, or is he going to turn course and return to his meddling in Syria and strengthening Saudi and U.S. hand?
Well, I sincerely hope that he would not go back to his old ways. I think at the present time he realizes that he needs to stabilize the situation. It's a very, very serious blow to the Turkish armed forces. It has created a major breach within its ranks. And so what he's trying to do is to turn to Putin as well as to the Islamic Republic because he has taken on the U.S. as well. And I think he anticipates that he's not going to get very far with the U.S. and that he really needs to shore up his flanks and to secure his flanks so that he has a fallback position. Although I do not anticipate anything dramatic with respect to Syria. If anything, it would be very, very incremental. But definitely he wants to take major steps vis-a-vis Russia as well as the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Well, I'm really glad we're talking to you, Zafar. And clearly, this problem, we're going to have to get back to. So thank you again very, very much.
It's
and
my great
look
pleasure.
Forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Zafar Bengage, crescent-online.net. And I want to thank Hanny very much. And, of course, Indigenous Waves is coming up.